Mr. Gallivan, whenever you're ready. Whenever you're ready.
Your Honor, if it pleases the Court.
Proceed, please.
Counsel. Your Honor, this case has several issues, but they all relate back to one major issue. Should the police have ever entered Mr. Roberts' apartment? As the Court read in our brief, the police received a call from somebody saying, we think that this person has stolen property and is carrying a gun. The police did some investigation, asked some questions through a neighbor in a neighboring apartment, found out that there's a gentleman that goes by the name of B who drives a specific vehicle. They checked that vehicle, and it was registered to Brian Roberts. They knew from the manager what apartment Mr. Roberts may be in. The manager told them it was leased to somebody by the name of Davis. The police did approximately a 30-minute surveillance on this apartment, saw one individual walk out, a black male, smoked a cigarette, and walked back in. The neighbors in the apartment described B to the detectives as a white, small male, approximately 5 foot, I think, about 125 pounds. The police never saw this individual when they were watching the apartment. The police called for some backup because they didn't know how many people were in the apartment to watch maybe a back door or something. The police go up and knock on the door. Mr. Roberts comes to the door, answers the door, identifies himself as Brian Roberts. The police say, well, we have some arrest warrants for Brian Roberts. He says, okay, take me. I'm Mr. Roberts.
Okay, stop right there. Up to this point, nothing, no constitutional violation.
No, sir.
Okay, proceed.
I didn't get the sense that he said, take me. He identified himself. He said, I'm Brian Roberts. Did he actually say, take me, arrest me now, or is that the implication of your statement? I know you perhaps didn't intend to be precise about it, but that exchange may be important to the officers, to what ensued.
Yes, sir.
So help me with what exactly the exchange was.
Mr. Roberts testified that when he said, I'm Mr. Roberts, I don't remember his specific words, to be honest with you, Your Honor, but he said, I'm Roberts, we can go. The officer said, now hold on, wait a minute, we want to see who you really are. Words to that effect. That's what Mr. Roberts testified to. The officer then asked Mr. Roberts for identification. Mr. Roberts then turned to go into the apartment to get it. The officers followed him. That's where we think the violation took place. At this point, Mr. Roberts matched the physical description of the individual they were looking for. He identified himself as Brian Roberts. The police had arrest warrants for a Brian Roberts. They should have arrested him at that point, and that would have been the end of it. The only information they had at that point was that there was somebody who may have stolen property and may have a gun. Possession of a laptop and a gun in and of themselves are not violations of the law. The police had no right to follow Mr. Roberts.
Did they have a probable cause to arrest him standing at the door?
They had an arrest warrant to arrest him standing at the door.
Well, just a minute. That's an interesting point, because I was under the impression that they only develop the information that he had either traffic or whatever warrants out 30 minutes ahead of time. I don't understand how they would have had an arrest warrant at that time.
I can't say that they actually had an arrest warrant in their hand, but they had done a background check when they checked the car and found out that he had open warrants.
Outstanding warrants.
Yes, sir. Before they knocked on the door.
Sir.
Yes, sir.
Which means that he's arrestable on site.
Yes, sir.
Now, these are misdemeanor warrants.
Yes, sir.
If it had been felony warrants, there's no question, but they could have entered the house. Do you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
So it boils down then to, in your argument, to the status of the law with regard to the consequences of attending a misdemeanor violation and warrant. Under our case law, do you tell me where we are with regard to the entry into a home? I thought that the cases said that, not all may do that, but that you could, that was a sufficient authority to enter.
I think if Mr. Roberts had stayed in the home, or if somebody else had answered the door and they had reason to believe Mr. Roberts was in the home, then I think they would be justified in saying, we have an arrest warrant for Roberts. We think he's here. Maybe we saw him earlier, whatever. But that's not what the facts say in this case. The facts in this case, he identified himself.
You're saying they should have arrested him They should have arrested him on the spot, taken him away, and not entered the apartment. That's your argument?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, that's why I'm going to go back to exactly what the exchange was between in the knock and the response. And he asked, let's go back to that language. As you understand, what was it? What happened?
The testimony is a little inconsistent between what the officer testifies to and what Mr. Roberts testifies to.
Well, if you're the posture of the case, let's assume that the officer's testimony is the one we accept.
The officer does not say that, from what I recollect, that Mr. Roberts indicates, okay, I'm Mr. Roberts, take me away. The officer just testifies that Brian identifies himself as Mr. Roberts. They say, we've got some warrants for you. He says something along the lines of okay or something to that effect. And then they say, well, wait, we want to see your ID first. And that's when he turns to go into the apartment. And based on those facts, the government wants to argue, well, they had to enter for police safety. Well, I understand police safety, that they need to protect themselves. However,
well, let me ask you this. If they had reason to believe that Roberts, for whom they had a warrant, was inside the apartment, could they go into the apartment and get him?
If they had more than what they have in this case, I think so.
My question, if they had reason to believe that Roberts, for whom they had a warrant, was inside the apartment, could they go in and get him?
For a misdemeanor warrant, I would think not. Not on reason to believe.
Were they justified in asking for identification after he identified himself, that they wanted further verification that he was, in fact, who he said he was? Were they justified in asking for identification?
I believe they are justified in asking for identification. However, I don't think they were justified in following him into the home to get it.
How far into the home did they go?
They stepped through the threshold, in through the door, and shined their flashlight into the remainder of the apartment because it was dark.
Now, for protective purposes, were they justified to take a few steps in and just kind of check out things? They didn't know who was in there. They'd heard that he might be in possession of a firearm. He's going off to grab an ID.
Yes, sir. I think based on the fact that they saw another individual there, they had the right to see if that individual was maybe standing somewhere, going to try to jump him or something like that. But they shined their flashlight into an entertainment center crevice to see, and they saw a magazine. Now, possession of a magazine, gun magazine, is not in and of itself illegal. But that's what they used to go further into the apartment.
So what do you say to the obvious argument that comes to mind that the man said, I'm Roberts, and you said that the officer wasn't satisfied that wanted an ID. But at that point, he certainly had probable cause to believe that this was a subject for whom he could arrest at that point. And the subject himself steps back into the apartment. Now, the argument would follow that the officer then had a right to step in at least to protect themselves, because otherwise he's vulnerable. Now, there's a Ninth Circuit case that says you got to effect arrest outside. But what's different in this fact pattern is that the identification of the suspect was not complete. We just the probable cause to. He says, I'm Roberts, and the officer said, I want to know, you give me some ID. And so at that point, the argument would flow, the officer had a right to step inside the threshold and do exactly what he did, put the light out. Otherwise, he's hanging out there with not knowing what's there. And, of course, that your time is up. I wanted to tell you, put that in front of you, because at some point somebody needs to address that.
May I respond briefly, Your Honor?
Very briefly.
The point, in my opinion, the police cannot manufacture the circumstances which allow them to enter the apartment, which is what they did in this case. They asked for ID. They knew he was going to go in, so they followed him under these pretext, and I think that should be illegal.
Thank you, Mr. Gallivan. You still have 2 minutes for rebuttal, okay? Ms. Leahy.
Good morning. May it please the court. My argument is essentially in line with Mr. Gallivan's argument. The court, in denying the motion to suppress for all defendants, relied on United States versus Virgil for the proposition that law enforcement have the implicit authority to enter a residence to effectuate an arrest. And, Your Honor, I would submit to this court that it is for the limited purposes of effectuating an arrest which allows police officer to enter a home when there is not a warrant for an arrest. And in this case, when Mr. Roberts comes to the door of the apartment that's designated his apartment, where his car is out parked right outside, where he fits the description of Brian Roberts as the slight white male, and it's also important to note that there were other residents of the apartment described to the police. Mr. Roberts is the only white male. And then he comes through the door and says, "Yes, I'm Brian Roberts." At that point, they don't need to go into the apartment to effectuate the arrest.
But they asked for the ID. Are you saying that that is that they were wrong in even asking for an ID?
No, I'm not saying they're wrong for.
But if they were not wrong, it seems to me then they could then ask for the ID and act to secure, for their own safety, secure whatever area this individual was going to obtain his ID. No more.
I'm not saying they're wrong to ask for an ID. I think it was completely unnecessary at that point to ask for an ID. There's nothing inherently wrong about that, but they essentially directed Mr. Roberts back into the house and then followed him into the house without his permission or consent.
But the predicate of that, that assumes that the officer knew they didn't have ID on him. In other words, he said, "You show me your ID." I assume he could, one possibility, the more likely possibility, would he would reach his pocket and pull out his driver's license or something and pull out his wallet.
And
he would go, then he would, your argument presupposes that when you say that the manufactured circumstances, that he would go back to the apartment to get ID.
Well, Your Honor, the record is a little unclear on that. What I don't understand, honestly, as long as we're talking about an unclear record, is why at that point the officers don't frisk Mr. Roberts for their own safety and look for ID, because he's arrestable at that point. They could have cuffed him at that point, patted him down for weapons, and searched for ID also, and they didn't do that. It doesn't make sense to me why that didn't occur either.
Well, if you didn't ask for ID and it turned out to be the wrong person, then they don't want to get in that pickle. And as I understand it, you said that he was the only white guy there, and so that reinforces the certainty that they had the right guy. But I didn't understand that the police officer knew that there was one, was there anybody else in there, and they didn't know whether they were white, Latino, or what.
My understanding is that, excuse me?
They did know there was somebody else in there. The black male was seen. And went back into the apartment.
Smoking.
But they didn't know whom else was in there. I mean, the implication is that he was the only white guy, so that he has to be the one.
He says he is Brian Roberts. He's a slight, small white male, young white male. He fits the description. His car is parked outside, and he concedes his identity. So, Your Honor, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, I'm guessing it's a duck.
Yeah, but it unnecessarily does not necessarily mean that there's any type of violation here. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the police should not confirm the individual's identification.
Yeah.
I mean, and I understand what you're saying, that they may have had enough, but, you know, these type of things happen all the time where you think you have the right person and it's not the right person. I'm not sure, and again, I go to the, you know, if they could ask for an ID, if they could secure that information, then it seems to me if this person walks into the house to obtain that at the very least, they have an interest in protecting themselves in that area. They shined the flashlight in that area where he picked up the ID and saw the magazine, and then I believe that he said, yes, the gun is over here underneath the couch. And
That's not quite how it happened, but
it
was very, very close. The testimony was that the entertainment center was merely 6 to 7 feet from the front door. They saw the magazine. At that point, they tell Mr. Roberts to stop. He stops. They place him in handcuffs. And at that point, it's unclear whether he's asked or volunteers the information, but indicated, oh, by the way, there's a gun underneath the couch as a means of when he's already handcuffed, Your Honor. He's already under arrest.
The statement about the gun came only when they found the ammunition, and then when they stopped to go get the ammunition, and he as I understood the record, and that's why I found out this accurate, then he said that he pointed to where the gun was.
Yes, it was only after they start retrieving the ammunition that the statement comes out that where the gun is. That's correct, Your Honor.
Did they handcuff him before or after they noticed the magazine and the ammunition?
Right after they noticed the ammunition, Your Honor.
Anything else, please? Ms. Lane?
No, I believe that's it, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Not your problem.
Oh, thank you, Judge Prado.
Oh, Mr. Ginn.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. As this court is well aware, none of these Fourth Amendment cases fit neatly with any doctrinal approach. The touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. We measure the intrusion on the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights versus the governmental interest at stake in the particular fact pattern. In this case, the sole issue really concerns the officers taking, and it's in the record and it's found by the district court, one step inside the door to shine a flashlight in the direction that Mr. Roberts is walking. As they shine the light into this darkened apartment, they see a magazine and ammunition on the entertainment center. They order him to stop. They then place him in handcuffs and proceed to secure the premises. Specifically, the testimony is that it was dark. I had my small flashlight in my hand, and I shined it towards the entertainment center where he was going to reach, since we were told he had a gun. I was making sure there wasn't nothing there that was a threat to me or Detective Spencer. It's very clear.
Is it the case that before they ever arrived there, to the front door, they had been told by the apartment that the description of this individual had included an episode in which he had attempted to sell a computer and he was wearing a gun?
In fact, the testimony was that he'd actually, one of the persons who he was showing the computer had handled the gun. And so it was not even just this amorphous, they saw a gun. The gun had been physically manipulated by the person, I guess, just to see a gun. I'm not sure exactly why, but that was in the record, that they knew, based on the information that they had at the time, there were multiple individuals inside this apartment. They knew that one of those individuals was seen with a firearm. It's a very interesting.
Once they found that first gun underneath the couch, did that then open the door to further search to find the shotgun? How do we go from the first gun to the second?
Well, what happens is there is the ammunition on the entertainment center. As they place Roberts in cuffs, he spontaneously says the gun is under the couch. At that point, there is an individual sitting on the couch. They immediately get that person and move him off to the side. They then go to the back room and knock on the door. It is locked or shut. At that point,
what justified them going to the back room?
That was,
I mean,
it was
a protective search for their safety. They're here. They get the gun. They got these individuals that were in that room. Now we're going to another further search that's opening up the door to further search. How did it get justified going to that second door?
It's actually just a classic protective sweep. They are going towards the back room to get the remaining individuals in the house that they know are there and move them to an area where they can be secured. Only when they enter that room do they look and see the firearm. They weren't looking for firearms.
So they were aware that there were other individuals in the house besides the person that met them at the door and the person sitting on the couch.
The person that they observed outside was not one of the persons in the living room. That's correct.
So then they were aware that there were other individuals in the house and they'd already found a gun, and for their own protection, the protective search was expanded to the back room.
And it's really not... It is a sweep in the sense that they are just, this is the classic case where they are not looking for a firearm, they're looking for individuals. Only once they get everybody secured in the living room, then do the officers actually lift up the couch and retrieve the firearm that was identified by Roberts. So they actually secure the premises before they even get that firearm that's underneath that couch, because it took two officers, one to lift it, one to retrieve
it. It's not
the firearm.
Like yesterday's case that we had. I think you were here.
Yes. It's very interesting because every case is so unique. And in researching this, it occurred to me that there is this case called Watson that this court issued in 2001 that I sort of stumbled across, but it's directly relevant. It has to do with the principle that you can arrest somebody outside the home and you can enter the home if you have grounds to believe that your safety is at issue. The only way, by extrapolation, the point I'm making is that had they effectuated the arrest outside the home, given what they knew, they could have probably entered the home and done a protective sweep long enough to secure the situation. But regardless of whether they could have arrested him outside or whether they waited to get identification, the fact is that the intrusion of taking one step inside the threshold to maintain control of the suspect, just to make sure that nothing went awry for their own safety, and they could see, this court found, they could see through the opened door other individuals in that room, the darkened room, that was a perfectly reasonable step for the officers to take in balance to the potential risks that they faced. This wasn't a situation where they just burst into the apartment. It's very clear that they simply stopped. And as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, at the time they asked the question for ID, they had no idea what the answer would be. He may have said, I don't have any. They didn't know whether he had a wallet and he could have produced it immediately. It was just one of those things where he turned to retrieve the ID, and they just basically shined their light to see where he was going, and that's when they saw the magazine and the ammunition.
Were they justified in seizing and confiscating these weapons? If it was just a protective search, they feel safe at the end of the investigation, if they arrest the person who had a warrant, do they give the weapons back, or were they justified in taking them down there and checking them out and doing further investigation of those weapons?
In our brief, we cite a Sixth Circuit case called Bishop, which essentially points out that following the Supreme Court's decision in Coolidge, that officers may seize objects that are inherently dangerous as part of a protective sweep. It's a little, the district court sort of relies on plain view, which isn't exactly what the case is here, because as you know, a firearm can be legally possessed, so not every firearm is just subject to seizure. But in the context of a protective sweep where you have quickly moving events, much like a Terry stop, you can secure an item such as a weapon long enough to facilitate your investigation and maintain the status quo. Now, of course, once it was determined that these individuals had felony records and were therefore felons in possession, then they became evidence. But they were seized just temporarily to maintain officer safety.
So were the weapons left there and returned, or were they taken back to police headquarters?
Well, once it was determined that Mr. Booth and Mr. Roberts both were felons, they were seized as evidence. And
when was that determined?
I believe within 30 minutes or so of having found the weapons. I think the FBI was ultimately called and took over the case for the local Midland authorities.
So this would be, the government's not arguing that any time you go to somebody's house and you see a gun.
Absolutely.
You can, if the police come to my house and they happen to look in my house and there on the couch is a gun, the policeman's not justified in going and grabbing my shotgun or my gun or my...
Every Fourth Amendment case is dependent on its unique individual facts. And in the abstract, a lawful possession of a firearm is simply that, lawful possession. In the context of a domestic disturbance where you have, you know, all sorts of individuals, children, you know, you name it, an inflamed, hostile situation, maybe securing the weapon is appropriate under those facts. Certainly, the government is not arguing any sort of bright-line rule that you can always seize a lawfully possessed firearm.
I think analytically, it's necessary to the effective application of the protective sweep doctrine that to pick up a weapon and to put it out of reach cannot be a prohibited seizure. Otherwise, you say, well, you can see the gun there, but you can't move it and protect yourself. So, I mean, you can't move it out. If you can't pick it up, move it out of the reach of other people, then you really gutted any notion of a protective sweep, because it could not. To me, while the line is not bright, the point at which you don't get to a seizure until you either have exhausted the protective search reaches itself. Or you don't return the weapon when the risk is dissipated. That's kind of a common sense notion, and I would think that's what essentially the Supreme Court was saying. If you pardon my attributing common sense to the High Court.
Well, as we all know, the Fourth Amendment, Terry really, I think, was the first important case in which the court began to discuss situations involving less than probable cause, less than a warrant. And essentially, it was a recognition that law enforcement officers need the ability, based upon ever-changing facts, to make split-second decisions to temporarily maintain the status quo for their safety and the safety of others. And that is essentially the doctrine from which all of the protective sweep cases flow. And essentially, what we come down to is a situation where an officer needs to have an articulable basis to believe that there are individuals present, that there are weapons present, that there are tangible things, articulable things that give them pause to believe that their safety or the safety of others might be in jeopardy. There's a recent opinion from this court in which the officers lacked any knowledge that there was anybody else in the home, and this court found that the protective sweep was not justified. This case, from the very inception, when they received information about stolen items and firearms, the individual was seen with the firearm. They had a good idea he was in the house. Once they approached the door, it turned out that it was very likely that Mr. Roberts was who he said he was. They asked for identification. Under all of those circumstances, the minimal one-step intrusion into the threshold of the home, there's just no other way to say it, but that was reasonable in light of the facts that the officers had before them and the interest that the government has in protecting their safety and the safety of the other occupants in the building. And essentially, to sum up, in this case, I believe that the district court correctly denied the motion to suppress, that in this case, the officers, I think that it was very reasonable, the actions that they took, they were very measured. There is nothing here to suggest that they were attempting to do some full-blown search. In fact, the record refutes that notion. They simply did all that was necessary to secure the premises once they had discovered the firearm. And that Nothing in this court's case law and nothing from the Supreme Court would suggest that the actions in this case were unreasonable to the extent that they would violate the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Gale. Mr. Gellman, you have 2 minutes to rebuttal.
General counsel for the government points out that, well, it wasn't a violation, but if it was, it was a small one because they only took one step. Well, where do we draw the line? One step? 2 steps? 10 steps? When do we say you can't violate somebody's rights? I would argue that the shining of the light was also the violation. The record shows that was 6 or 7 feet from the door. What if they turned the corner and shined it the other way and saw something out? So are we going to let them go in then? The point is they should have never gone into this apartment. Whether it's for officer safety or whatever reason, they didn't have the right to enter this gentleman's apartment and to seize anything. They did not have probable cause, I don't believe, to enter the apartment. The testimony is clear from the officer that we didn't know who Roberts was. We didn't even know if he lived there. However, when they knocked on the door, the gentleman said, "I'm Roberts. Take me," essentially. They chose not to do that. They wanted to see an ID, which they have the right to ask for. However, they also had the right to arrest him, to further question him. The evidence is consistent that he was cooperative, didn't try to flee. He was answering their questions. Once inside the house, he even volunteered where the gun was. They didn't do any of that outside the home. They could have asked him, "Can we go in and see who's there? Can you tell us who's there? Do you have any weapons in the house?" As Ms. Leahy pointed out, they never patted him down to see if he had any weapons on him. If they were so concerned with officer safety, that would have been step one, I would think. The mere presence of a gun and the mere presence of a laptop computer in and of themselves are not violations of the law. That did not give them the right to enter that home. They knocked on that door and went into that home for one purpose, to find that gun. And they did that by claiming officer safety. We believe that violated Mr. Roberts' rights and that his conviction should be overturned.
Thank you, Mr. Gellman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Leahy?
Thank you, Your Honor. Physical entry into a person's home is the primary evil which the Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect. And all warrantless searches are presumed unreasonable unless there is consent. There was no consent in this case. Unless there are exigent circumstances, there was none of that. Your Honors, let me address just briefly, the notion of the protective sweep, since that was talked about at length with the appellee. A protective sweep has essentially a four-prong test. The first prong is that the officers must be in the house for a legitimate reason. And we do not concede that the officers were in this house for a legitimate reason. Number two, the sweep must be supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion that the area to be swept harbors an individual posing danger to those on the scene. Now, the only information the officers had about anybody who might have posed a danger to them was information about Mr. Roberts himself. Mr. Roberts was the only person who was described by other individuals in the apartment to have a gun. They saw a gun on him. There was no reason, I believe, assuming that they were even in the house for a legitimate reason, there was no articulable facts that were brought before the court to say that the house was harboring anybody who could pose a danger to the officers. That was not done. In fact, during the course of the entire suppression hearing, there was nothing voiced about officer safety to begin with. Now my time is up. I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Gellman, you're court appointed. The court appreciates your service to the court, obviously without individuals like you to do this type of service. Individuals would not have this good a representation, and we thank you.